with Mr. Howard Vollum at the Tektronix headquarters in Beaverton. The date is March 26, 1980. The interviewer is Linda Brody for the Oregon Historical Society. Mr. Vollum, are you a native Oregonian?
Yes, I am. I was born in Portland. Lived over in the Solid District of Portland.
Is that where you grew up?
Yes, that's where I grew up. Mm-hmm.
Were your parents Oregonian?
Yes, my parents were both Oregonians. My father's people came here and homesteaded in the Gresham area. And my mother's people came here from Austria and via Wisconsin. Uh-huh. And then to Oregon. So I've lived here all my life.
Where did you receive your education?
Well, I went to grammar school at St. Agatha's School in the Solid District, and to high school at St. Stephen's, which is over on 42nd and Salmon, I believe. And then I went 2 years to what was then Columbia University, which is now the University of Portland. And then I went 2 years to Reed and graduated from Reed in physics in 1936. Columbia at that time had only 2 years in science. They had 4-year programs, but they only had 2 years in science.
Were you influenced by any of the people on the faculty at Columbia at that time? Reed?
Yes, very much at Reed. The faculty of the physics department was very important to me. The head of the department was a well-known physicist, Dr. Knowlton. We have a street named after him on the Beaverton property. And the man I was most closely associated there was Dr. Marcus O'Day, who is also a physicist, and who left Reed some years after I did and went into government research work till his death a few years ago. I think all of the members of the Reed faculty were inspirational. They had an unusually able faculty, especially at that time. They had Dr. Knowlton, who was nationally known as a physics teacher and had other people, Dr. F. L. Griffin, who was very well known as a mathematics teacher, and quite a number of people who I think were an influence to everyone who was there. Dr. Aragon in the history department, and another Dr. Griffith, who was a psychologist. And
you, I believe, wrote your senior thesis on aspects of the oscilloscope or development of the oscilloscope.
Well, I have been interested in oscilloscopes for a long time. I had built an oscilloscope before I went to Reed. Actually, I was out a year between my sophomore and junior years because that was the depth of the Depression and my parents couldn't afford to send me to school anywhere. And so I was out for a year and working part-time, and I built an oscilloscope at that time, and I built several more while I was at Reed. But my thesis was not on the oscilloscope, but it was on a another piece of electronic lab gear called a beat frequency oscillator. And this one was a little different than the more conventional ones. It had a meter which indicated the frequency it was generating rather than read it from a dial, as was customary. When you read the meter, it was whatever it was actually generating, whereas the dial might have indicated one frequency and might have been generating another one.
Can you trace back your earliest interest in science? Did you have an interest before you went to Columbia and Reed, perhaps as a small child?
Yeah, I was interested in radio a lot at that time. I think I've heard a number of the Portland radio stations when they came on the air. My father, who was an automobile mechanic, built some radios, and I worked with him. I got interested in radio at that time, which was really about, well, it was one of the most important segments of electronics, probably the most important segment of electronics at that time. And I used to repair radios. As a matter of fact, that's the way I made money to go to college, was repairing radios.
You were part of the war effort, I understand, and you began with the Defense Department as a civilian employee, and later was in the service as a Signal Corps officer.
Well,
is that correct?
No, that's not quite correct. I had a low number in the draft, and I was drafted and went to Camp Roberts, California. We were in one of the first groups to go to Camp Roberts. It was brand new, and I was there for 9 months after taking the basic military training in an infantry battalion. I stayed on and in a headquarters company taking care of the radio equipment for them for the next two groups, and then I'd applied to officer candidate school, but I also applied to a program that was called the Electronics Training Group, and it was an attempt by people, I think it was Dr. Bush's program with the president, to have a sort of two-pronged effect. In England, they were in great need of technicians to maintain the radar equipment that they had. The British educational system at that time was not well suited to developing a series of engineers or technicians. The universities were excellent, as they always have been, but they concentrated really on developing scientists rather than people who could operate and take care of the equipment. And so the idea was to commission Americans who had either an engineering or a science degree, and send them to England. And the period was supposed to be 6 months. And you spent the first 6 weeks or so of that taking training courses on the equipment that you were going to maintain. And then you went into the field in a radar site, and were a radar maintenance officer for the rest of the period. Then the idea was, of course, the World War hadn't started. I mean, the U.S. was not involved in it at that time. And the idea then would be to provide a group of officers who had been actually on active radar sites. And of course, Britain was being bombed, and so they had a chance to really work under actual conditions. So I was selected in that group and commissioned a second lieutenant. It was a direct commission, and I was the first person at Camp Roberts to receive a direct commission. So I was a corporal one day and a second lieutenant the next day.
It's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
The war effort, well, actually what I want to say is the war effort contributed a great deal to science, I would think.
Yes.
Technology. Were you able to profit from your experience as a Signal Corps officer?
Oh yes, very much, because I went to England and took the course. I took a course on a searchlight control radar set, but I never went on an active searchlight site, because I was selected from, as a result of this course, to go to one of the British radar labs. And this was one which was operated by the Ministry of Supply, who were the responsible for army equipment. And I went to England and went to the lab of an organization called the Air Defense Research and Development Establishment. It's ADRDE. And they were located at that time on the south coast of England, a town called Christchurch. And I went to work there on the development of a radar set, which was designed to control the fire of the Coast Artillery guns at Dover. They, of course, had a radar set on them, but we were developing a much more accurate one than the one that was in use at that time. And I spent about almost 2.5 years on that project, sort of 6 months at a time. I always was going to be sent back, except there was an extension came and it kept going on. So I didn't come back until very close to D-Day, which was May something. I don't remember the date. And I was lucky enough to work with a group of very, very good scientists and engineers, and we were working in an area of radar development, which was right at the cutting edge of the technology. We were using very short pulses and the shortest wavelengths that were available at that time, so that I had an opportunity to work in a in an area of radar which was very important, very difficult, and of course test equipment for this sort of thing was not very available. We had to make our own in most cases, and the part of the radar set that I was concerned with was the indicator section, that is the display section of the radar, the thing that the operator operators look at, and that's really a sort of a specialized form of an oscilloscope. And so the techniques that I learned and the technology that developed was directly applicable to oscilloscope design, which of course was my interest before that time and at that time and after that time. So that it worked in very directly. And then when I came back from England, I was sent to the Signal Corps laboratories at Bellmar, New Jersey, and there we worked on a variation of this Coast Artillery radar set, which was designed to track mortar shells and to locate the mortar that fired the shell by taking extrapolating the part of the trajectory that you could observe back to its source. This Coast Artillery radar set that I worked on was designed so that you could not only see the ship that was the target, but you could also see the splash from the shells when they landed around it. And generally it's called a shell splash radar. In order to do that, you had to have these short pulses and high frequencies, otherwise it would all blur together into, you couldn't tell the shells from the target. But this lets you then make corrections for the next shot. If you didn't hit where you aimed, you took appropriate corrective action. And that wasn't possible until that time. And the problem with the mortar locating radar is to see a rather small thing at a substantial distance. 60 millimeter mortar shell is only about a foot long, and you had to see that at 5,000 yards, and it's fairly small, and it's going pretty fast, so you don't have much time. And that was a device we were just getting into reasonable shape to use when the war was over, which was perfectly all right with me.
Did the armed forces go on to use that?
Yes, they do, and of course they have sets for that purpose now, and the technology is much advanced, and of course the computing facilities are so much greater that you can do a lot better with a smaller amount of information. But it's kind of interesting that the measure of the extent that the U.S. would go to protect soldiers. A mortar is one of the deadliest weapons, cause more casualties than most other ones. And the U.S. government was willing to spend large sums of money to put a radar set in the front lines, and the chances of it getting destroyed were pretty good. And these were such which at that time were, my guess would be, in the price range of $250,000 to $500,000, which were very likely to get blown up
A lot of money.
And of course, and they cost a lot more than that now.
Oh, yes. You were awarded several awards. The Oak Leaf Cluster and Legion of Merit.
Well, I got Legion of Merit for the work in England. And then an Oak Leaf Cluster to it, which is the equivalent of a second one for the work in the United States.
How did you become acquainted with Jack Murdoch?
Oh, well, when I graduated from Reed, I went to work then as a radio serviceman, and I had an independent business of my own also as a radio serviceman, and I just heard that Jack was opening up this store out on Foster Road for it was to be radio and appliances, refrigerators and ranges and that sort of thing, and he needed a radio serviceman. He was interested in radio and was a good serviceman himself, and so I went out there, and as a result of that I set up the radio service department in his store. And so I worked with Jack for a couple of years. Then when I got drafted, I went that way, and Jack eventually went in the Coast Guard and closed the store. And
did you renew your friendship after the
war? Oh, yes, and we, of course, corresponded during the war and so on. And we talked about the possibility of manufacturing instruments before the war and after the war. During the war, it got more, it was more evident that chances were better. We probably knew more about it, and there was a lot of rebuilding to do after the war, so we decided to start off and have a try at it.
You didn't waste very much time either, because it was, I believe I read January 2nd, 1946, when you incorporated.
Yeah, that's right. And I got out in, I guess it was probably about November, I believe. And Jack got out a little bit later. I had, they had a point system, and I had a lot of points because of the overseas service, so I got out a little earlier. But then we got together at that time.
Were you the only partners, or did you have, were there others involved?
Yes, there were some others. These were mostly friends of Jack's. He'd come from one of them that he knew in Portland was a neighbor of his. But this fellow was an accountant.
What was his name?
His name was Glenn McDowell. And then there were several other people who were Coast Guard buddies of his who came with us. But Jack and I always had the principal parts.
I see. What kind of business did you engage in at that time? Was it were you manufacturing or developing, or was it a combination with appliance repair, or was the extent of your business?
I mean, before the war,
no,
war
I mean
after.
Afterwards, after. You
well,
started.
No, we started off as Tektronix started off in an effort to manufacture to. Design and manufacture cathode ray oscilloscopes, and we were in a building on Southeast 7th and Hawthorne, which was built for us at that time, and we leased, and because that was on a fairly busy street, because we knew we weren't going to have any income from the manufacturer for some time. We put in a radio store there, a radio retail store and a service department. And then that was, as we, our Tektronix activities grew, that eventually moved next door, and that's that was called Hawthorne Electronics, and that's now Hawthorne Stereo.
Was your oscilloscope priced competitively?
Oh yes, one of the big advantages we had was substantially lower price than any of the competitors, in addition to superior performance. So we had everything going for us. The first oscilloscope we had sold for $595, and the competition was more like $1,800 at the time. So we had a lot of advantages. But it's kind of interesting that Tektronix right today manufactures an oscilloscope which is very superior to that for approximately the same price.
Oh,
in
that is
current,
interesting.
Current dollars.
what market did you sell to at this time?
Well, our market was the electronics industry as such, and our sales were through manufacturers' representatives, and we were lucky to get at the outset two very good ones, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and both of them were had been in business before the war and had established good contacts and had other lines. As a matter of fact, both of them were principal line was Hewlett-Packard, and Bill Hewlett was a Signal Corps, fellow Signal Corps officer of mine, and I knew him during the war. And he was of help to us in getting contact, making contact with these representatives. So they sold them to the electronics industry, and of course before the war there really was very little as an electronics industry, but wartime spawned a lot of activities. There were many people who received a lot of training into it. People who had been college profs who became very active in engineers, and people who weren't active in engineering prior to that time at all, but who had become competent engineers. And those people didn't go back to their old professions in many cases, but went into the electronics business. So we sold to nationally established companies right from the start, like RCA. We can almost name any of the electronics companies that were in existence.
Interesting. How did you select the name Tektronix?
Well, we wanted a name that that you could trademark, and that sort of ruled out some types of names. We felt that if you choose a name that has old names of cities or something like that in it, then or general terms like consolidated engineering companies in almost every state, you couldn't get trademark in in lots of areas. And we wanted, we had intention of always it being a national concern because there really wasn't any electronics industry or of any concern in Portland. And so we decided that we'd have to have a coin name. And that's just a combination of technical electronics. Then we made the spelling of it. We thought easy by making it with a K and an IX. And we have a collection had in the mailroom of the stuff that comes in with all the spellings, and you get some pretty weird ones, and there's still to this day there are lots of people who spell it ICS. We always thought IX was simpler and shorter. And TECH a lot of times instead of TEK.
Did you mean yourself?
Well, Jack and I and the other people.
I was going to ask you, but I think you already covered this, how you integrated the activity of the retail store and your manufacturing.
Yeah.
And were you carrying on, did you say, at the same location?
Yes, but it wasn't really the same people. They were in the same place, and we owned both of them, but the manufacturing was in the back and upstairs, and the store was in the front.
I see. I think I read that you polled your employees in the late 1940s as your business was beginning to grow. You asked them where they would like to live, or what area would be most livable. Why did you do that?
Well, we had a five-year lease on this building we were in, and it was pretty obvious in a couple of years that it was going to be too small. Right? We were growing, and we thought that very likely we would be. Well, we have to find some place where there's a large enough ground to have a little bigger place. And those places, of course, were all outside of the city center. And we asked, we didn't do this any highly official way, but we just asked a lot of where people thought they'd like to be. And there was a pretty strong consensus that the west side, out of the ways from the city, was a good place. And we felt also it was good because it had an extremely wide variety of housing available in a relatively small radius. Where our Sunset Track was, there were some apartments in the Cedar Hill Shopping Center, or near the Cedar Hill Shopping Center at that time. There was land available for anything from a fraction of an acre to a number of acres. There were new houses of all in all price ranges going up around there. The Cedar Hills area was being developed. A number of people wanted to build their own house, and a number of our people did over a period of time. There's a lot of do-it-yourself activity, and so you could have a farm, or you could have an apartment, or anything in between, and all within a few minutes drive from that site. And that area was developing good schools, and I think it was a very good area.
Well, I would say so. Who were some of the employees who contributed to the company during that early period? Are there certain individuals that you can recall specifically?
Well, I think everybody contributed. Very, very, very much. I don't know if I'd, afraid my memory isn't as good as it should be about some of the names, but we've always been very fortunate in having an extremely competent, motivated group of people. And, I don't know, I think if I got mentioning, I'm sure to leave out more than I could include.
Your sunset plant was ready for use for occupation, I guess, in 1951?
Yes. See, that was just 5 years from when we started.
I see. What influenced your choice of the generous campus-like design of the sunset plant?
Well, if you had the land, and land wasn't was available and wasn't extremely expensive at that time, and the Sunset Tract sort of goes, only a part of it was flat, and that was the part that we built the first building on. The other goes up to up to the Barnes Road, and we had intended to, we never expected to be able to utilize the 5 acres that we had there. That was the building put up and thought would last for a while, but we had to add to that very shortly and then build another one over by Barnes Road. We had a real decision when we built that one because that hillside from, by Barnes Road had a lot of apple trees on it, and we had to decide whether to really cast our fate with oscilloscopes and or keep the Social Security having apples to sell.
Well, you've been fine with oscilloscopes, I would say. How many acres do you have on Sunset Campus?
Well, Sunset Campus is well, it originally was about 5 acres, and then we bought a couple, I don't know, maybe we may have had 8 or 9 acres at the time, but it wasn't very large. And then when we saw that that was going to be too small, then we bought the Beaverton tract, but the 300 acres.
And how many buildings do you have there?
I don't know. That's a not as simple problem as you think, because it's hard to decide what constitutes a building. But it's almost full now. It's very little room for additions now. I don't know the number, but the buildings take up space, and cars take up a lot of space, parking areas.
It's a very generous kind of design that you have there, though.
Yes, it's nice.
Appealing to the eye to look at.
I think our Wilsonville plant is even nicer as far as the attractive relationship to the trees and so on.
The environment.
Yeah.
Is your interest in constructing brick buildings, is that for energy efficiency or something that is appeals to your sense of permanency, or what is that?
Well, I think it's probably mostly the latter. Brick buildings can be energy efficient or not. The heat conductivity of brick is fairly good, so they're not as good an insulating wall as some other types. But it is attractive, and I think it has sort of permanent gives sort of impression of permanence. And we've used it, some buildings have largely brick and others have small elements of brick which ties them together when it may not be desirable to use brick all over like we have some which have metal paneling for the walls in some places, because it's possible to take that out and take equipment out, for instance, which you can't do with a brick wall. Then we had a lot more windows in the buildings that we built at one time when energy was cheap than we would have now. So the brick kind of became a little bit of a unifying factor for tectonic buildings. And I think it's a very good way to do that. It's attractive and it's permanent. And we have some inside brick walls, wall where you just have the brick on the outside and on the inside, and a cavity wall. And I think they're attractive and they're very durable. And they don't require any painting or anything like that. And over a period of time, you may pay as much to repaint the wall many times as you would to make it out of brick in the first place.
I'm sure that's true.
And it never does look as good.
In the early years, your company experienced a lot of growth, or almost immediately.
Yeah.
Were you meeting your expectations as far as manufacturing and sales forecasts were concerned?
Well,
did you do as well as you had hoped to do?
We did very, very much better than we had ever hoped in our fondest dreams. We didn't really plan on a quantitative basis, and you have to do that when you're larger, but our philosophy was to build the best instrument that we possibly could for the lowest price that we could come out with a satisfactory profit on it, and make all of them that people wanted to buy. We didn't say we're going to make X number of them in the next year or something like that. We had some ideas what we thought the market was, but in every case we were way too low. Electronics expanded faster, and we had we got a bigger part of the market than we had ever anticipated. Our competition didn't really do very well as far as responding, so we were always ahead of them technically.
How would you describe the labor market in this area? Has it been good for you?
Oh yes, the labor market is excellent here. The people are very competent, and I think the educational system is very good here, and people in the West, the Northwest, have a sort of independent attitude and a confidence that really doesn't matter if they've done something before. If somebody else can do it, they can do it, and they can do it better. And I think it really, the basis of the population around here, especially at that time, was oriented to farming, agricultural kinds of activities, and you have to be able to do everything on a farm. You can't whistle up somebody to fix something, you have to do it yourself. And there was very little factory, I sort of call it factory heritage around here, which I think is a very undesirable sort of a circumstance, where perhaps some places in the East where man's parents and maybe his grandparents even worked under rather difficult conditions in the factory, and there were a lot of conflict between the management and them. And so they was naturally a great deal of mistrust between. But I don't think that was prevalent at all in the West, the whole West, and the Northwest even more, because it was just not very industrialized. And so people did not have a built-in distrust of the management.